Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 47. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your encouragement and generosity. You can find a full list of patrons on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. September's prize is a digital download of the album Elizabeth by Carlene, inspired by the life of Elizabeth I. I'll play you another song from this wonderful album shortly. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk about witchcraft and magic in Tudor England is Dr. Frances Young. Frances holds a PhD in history from the University of Cambridge and is a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society. He's the author of 12 books, including Magic as a Political Crime in Medieval and Early Modern England, and his research focuses on the history of religion and belief. My conversation with Frances straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song The Tower is from Carlene's album entitled Elizabeth. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Frances. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's great to be on this podcast, Natalie.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to chat with you. So, Frances, you're the author of 12 books, including one entitled Magic as a Political Crime in Medieval and Early Modern England. Now, before we dive into this fascinating topic, it'd be really helpful if you could just set the scene for us, just to help our listeners understand your work. What did people in late medieval and pre-Reformation Tudor England believe about magic?
Well, belief in magic was something that permeated every aspect of life, really, in early Tudor England. And it's something which we can find from the lowest to the highest in society, people believing that there were supernatural forces at work that were affecting their lives. And really, I suppose, the difference between religion, which was, you know, the great supernatural force of God working in your life, and magic, in one way, is that people who believed in magic thought that those supernatural forces could in some way be manipulated, could in some way be changed. And so we've got a whole range of beliefs in magic. We've got, at one end of the spectrum, a belief in witchcraft, so the idea that there might be malevolent people out there who have some mysterious power to harm you, perhaps just by looking at you, perhaps by thinking bad thoughts about you or speaking curses against you, right the way through at the other end of the spectrum to extremely learned natural magic. So something which is almost akin to a primitive form of science that we might think of, people believing that there are forces in the natural world that can be harnessed and manipulated, like the influence of the stars, you know, people who are expert astronomers, astrologers, learned people conducting their research entirely in Latin and Greek. So there's a whole range of supernatural belief, and it's certainly not confined just to ordinary people. It's something that goes right the way to the top.
Okay, and I imagine that some changes took place kind of after the Reformation in terms of what people believed. Could you go into this a little bit?
Absolutely. The Reformation is a really fascinating time for belief in magic and the supernatural, because it's something which carries on right the way through. It's a point of continuity between the pre-Reformation Catholic era and the post-Reformation Protestant era in England. But at the same time, there is a great deal of transformation, and I would argue, and I have argued in my writings, that there was almost a reformation of magic that goes alongside the reformation of religion that happens in the mid-Tudor period. And what I mean by that is that the way in which magic was thought of completely changes. So before the Reformation, there is a very diversified view of what magic might be. And magic is actually not treated as a particularly serious offence. It's mainly dealt with in the church courts. So they don't have the ability to put somebody to death. They don't have the ability to impose lethal punishment. And then suddenly it shifts in the middle of the 16th century, and magic becomes a crime in the true sense of the word, something that's punished by the state. And then we get a shift towards a much narrower idea of what magic is, that magic is something entirely satanic, magic is evil, and finally we get to a point where magic is equated totally with witchcraft towards the end of the 16th century. So the reformation of magic is really, it's not a decline in importance of magic. Magic still stays a very important part of people's lives, but it is increasingly demonized and portrayed as something evil.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So in terms of when magic was first linked with treason, is that in the 16th century then?
Well, no, that actually happens a lot earlier. That happens
right, okay.
Before century. There's this brief period in the 1320s, which I know is going way beyond your Tudor period, but there's a brief period when magic is associated with evil and with demonic pacts. And that's the time when you get the first instances in England of magic being linked with treason. But it carries on mainly because the Treason Act of 1352, which is the act that remains in force right through the Tudor period, and in fact is still in force in England today. That 1352 Treason Act is phrased in such a way that it covers magic. So the words are that any act that compasses or imagines the death of the king is treason. So compass or imagine, literally meaning that anyone who's thought about the death of the king, anyone who has taken any act to bring about the death of the king, whether or not that act actually will genuinely result in the king's death. And that's why the act is so clever, because it brings in magic and doesn't even require the judge who's convicting the person of treason to believe that magic is real. All that's required is that the person who was committing the treasonous act was attempting in whatever way to bring about the death of the king. So that's really where the medieval legacy comes into the Tudor period. And yeah, I think it's fair to say that during the Tudor period, the association between magic and treason is a point of continuity with the Middle Ages, rather than something that really increases, but it remains a very significant thing. And I think there are a few cases, like, for example, when Queen Elizabeth is attacked by magic, apparently in 1578, when it essentially expands out into a much bigger kind of witch hunt than it ever did in the medieval period.
Okay, and if you were convicted of magical treason, what punishment awaited you?
Well, any conviction for treason would result in hanging, drawing, and quartering.
Right.
So it was, you know, the most serious crime that could be committed. And the fact that it was done through magic didn't make any difference. What we tend to find, though, is that very few people were actually convicted of magical treason as the main charge. And I think we see this with Lord Hungerford in 1540. This is the guy who is one of Thomas Cromwell's associates. He's essentially blamed for the failure of the marriage with Anne of Cleves, and he suffers the consequences. And Hungerford, again, you know, the main thing that he's accused of is not magic. He's accused of sodomy, actually. But magic is thrown into the mix. Well, why is this? I think it's because magic is considered to be the sort of thing that traitors do. So there's a view in the Tudor, from the point of view of the Tudor state, that if you are a completely immoral, treasonous kind of person, then you're likely to involve the dark arts in your conspiracy. And so it tends to get thrown in there because it's a really nasty, sticky accusation. It's something which, once somebody has been accused of involvement in the dark arts, it taints them for life because it's a spiritual crime. And so I think the reason it's in there is basically to add this extra taint.
Okay, and you mentioned a couple of cases. Are there any other kind of high-profile cases in late medieval or Tudor England?
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of interesting cases. One case which is notable, not so much for the convictions that resulted, but for the lack of convictions, is a case in the reign of Henry VII, actually. It's in the late 15th century, 1497. And we have a case where essentially there's a conspiracy led by Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, who are trying to bring down Henry, and it's part of the sort of the Yorkist fight back against Henry VII. And what's interesting there is that Henry VII doesn't really take this very seriously, although the case is quite well documented. He doesn't seem to have cared very much about this kind of activity. Henry VIII, on the other hand, does take that kind of thing more seriously. Lord Hungerford probably is the most prominent case. John Storey is another interesting case. He is somebody who was very active in the reign of Mary in the burning of Protestant martyrs. And John Storey becomes a wanted man in the reign of Elizabeth, and he's hunted down, illegally in fact, by English agents, kidnapped and put on a ship and taken back to England because he'd gone into exile in the Low Countries and become a subject of the King of Spain. And the charge that was used in order to convict him was that he had plotted the Queen's death by treason. But it was a controversial case because he was now a subject of the King of Spain, so you can't technically commit treason if you're no longer an English subject, if you switched your allegiance completely. But the court simply ruled that, well, you can't change your allegiance. If you were born in England, you're a natural-born subject of the Queen. And so Storey ends up being killed for that. But he's later actually made blessed by the Roman Catholic Church and considered a martyr. So, yeah, that's a curious one. And then perhaps the strangest figure in all of this is a man called John Prestall. And Prestall is involved in serial acts of magical treason, including at one point he wants to burn down the port of Rochester using alchemical fire. So all sorts of things that he attempts to do. He attempts to kill the Queen using images, using effigy magic, sticking pins in images of Elizabeth. He attempts virtually every kind of treasonous magic you can imagine. And it carries on for decades, but every single time it happens, he is rehabilitated and he's let off the hook. And there's one very simple reason for that, which is that Prestall was an alchemist, or at least claimed to be an alchemist and capable of multiplying gold. And William Cecil was absolutely obsessed with alchemy. Elizabeth herself was obsessed with alchemy. And if somebody was believed to possess alchemical skill, then even if they committed the most heinous acts of treason, they might escape, because there was always this potential that the government could harness their abilities. I suppose it's a little bit like today, you'll get people who are convicted of hacking into government websites but end up being recruited by the government to work for them. It's a sort of the 16th century equivalent of that, in that, yeah, they are always a potential source of revenue. So people like that strangely escape time after time.
So you mentioned briefly the image magic, and I wanted to ask you about this. So in the late 1570s, there was some concern that image magic was being used against Elizabeth. Could you talk to us about this a little bit more, and how someone might use this against a royal person or any other person?
Yes, well, this is the most notorious case, really, and it's the closest that 16th century England came to having a full-blown witch hunt. You know, the only real full-blown witch hunt that took place in English history was in the 1640s, when Matthew Hopkins goes into East Anglia rounding up witches. But this is an earlier example. And what essentially happens is that in 1578, three effigies made of wax are found in a barn in Islington. And these effigies look a lot like Elizabeth and Cecil and Robert Dudley. And they're dressed in clothes, so great pains have been made to make them look like these figures, apparently. And not only that, but the figure that looks like Elizabeth has got the name Elizabeth carved into the wax. And these images have been placed underneath a pile of manure. And this is a classic magical technique, that you make an effigy of somebody, you then place it somewhere where it will slowly melt. And of course, manure will heat up and slowly melt wax. And as the wax melts, the sympathetic magic is supposed to bring about that person's demise. You know, the person will become ill and eventually die. And so these are very concerning, and they're boxed up and they're sent to the Privy Council, which at that time is not in London, because Elizabeth is on progress in Norfolk. So she's staying in the Bishop's Palace in Norwich, and the box is sent there. And Elizabeth is troubled by this. Elizabeth was not a particularly superstitious woman, but, you know, anybody of that era is going to find this a little bit on the disturbing side. And so she sends for the one man that she knows who has the ability to counteract evil magic, and that is John Dee, the astrologer and magician. And so Dee is summoned to Norwich, although by the time he gets there, Elizabeth has actually left. She's moved on her progress. But the courtiers and the Privy Council stay behind. And there, Dee performs some sort of ritual. He doesn't go into any details about what that ritual was, but I have argued that it was possibly an exorcism of some kind. Dee, of course, had been ordained priest earlier in his life, and he had access to various books of exorcism that had recently come out. Dee performs some kind of ritual there. And the problem was that Elizabeth herself was actually ill at the time. And so this witchcraft was suspected of having brought about her illness. In fact, she was ill because she had an abscess in her teeth, which happened a lot during her life because she ate so many sweets. But it was suspected to be witchcraft. And there was a great deal of concern from the councillors that she might die as a result of this. But what then happened was that it turned out that a local conjurer in London had actually made these effigies in order to bring about the deaths of three people in a love triangle who were completely unrelated to the royal court. So in fact, the effigy that had the name Elizabeth written on it was not Elizabeth, the Queen. These other effigies were not Cecil and were not Dudley. So the whole thing turned out to be a complete red herring. But it was too late, because by this time, Dudley had basically decided that he was going to start a witch hunt, and it was being used as an excuse to round up undesirables. And so throughout the southeast of England, you have magistrates seeking out people. There's an upsurge in people being accused of witchcraft. Not huge numbers, but, you know, you've certainly got, you know, tens of people, if not dozens of people, being rounded up in one go, which is the first time that had really happened in English history.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So were there tests at the time? You know, I've heard of tests done to prove whether you're a witch or not in later centuries. So were they doing that kind of thing in the 16th century as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The classic test to prove whether somebody is a witch would be swimming witches. So that's when, you know, somebody would have a rope tied around them. They'd essentially be trussed up and then they would be thrown in a body of water, not to be confused with ducking. Ducking was actually a quite different punishment for a different offence. But witch swimming, you'd then be thrown into the body of water to see whether you floated. If you floated, then you were considered to be guilty. That was because you'd rejected your baptism by becoming a witch. Therefore, the water of baptism was rejecting you. And if you sunk, then you were not a witch. But of course, you might drown as a result of that. So, I mean, that had been going on since Anglo-Saxon times, and it carried on going until the 19th century. Witch swimming was very popular. But yeah, the witchcraft was not a crime in England until 1542. So it wasn't on the statute books until then. And even then, it was then repealed shortly afterwards. And it wasn't until 1563 that we actually get a really fierce witchcraft act, which makes it possible for the courts to convict people of witchcraft and hang them for that offence.
Now, you mentioned John Dee when you were talking about the image magic, and he's such a fascinating character. Would love to talk to about him a little bit more. I recently was Googling him. I did a little Google experiment. I put in Elizabethan John Dee, and just the first search page alone comes up with things like magician, metaphysical guide, astrologer, you know, spoke to angels. So I'd love to hear more about this intriguing character and his connection to magic.
Yeah, Dee is endlessly fascinating. I think partly because so much documentation survives from his life. We have his personal diaries, we have his notebooks. They're all in the British Library. And he was a meticulous record keeper. And he was somebody who led a number of different lives, really. On one level, he was a courtier. On another level, he was a professional astrologer. He studied mathematics at the University of Cambridge and also University of Leuven in the Netherlands. And thought of himself as being an astrologer, a mathematician, a learned expert. One of the things that he did was to calculate the best day, the most propitious day on which Elizabeth could have her coronation. But he also has this secret life, and his secret life is communicating with angels via a medium. He himself didn't claim to have the ability to see the angels or speak to them. So he required somebody else to do that for him. And he goes through two main mediums, a man called Barnabas Saul, and then later a man called Edward Kelly. And Kelly has gone down in history as one of the greatest con men of all time, in the sense that Kelly was able to string Dee along for years and years with these extraordinary angelic revelations, and promised Dee things like buried treasure to solve all his financial problems, promised him that he would discover secrets that would bring him favor with the queen, that would bring him international renown. At one point, the two men head off to Bohemia, to the court of the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II, and there they try to convince Rudolf that they are successful alchemists. Ironically, it's actually only Kelly who's able to convince Rudolf, and Dee has to go back home with his tail between his legs, and ends his life as a poverty-stricken functionary running the collegiate church in Manchester. So in some ways, Dee's life is rather tragic, in that he never achieves these great occult promises that are made to him by Kelly and the angels. And an even crueler twist is when Kelly tells Dee that they must follow the command of the angels and swap wives. And that's something that Dee really doesn't want to do, and his wife doesn't want to do either. But he feels compelled to follow these commands from heaven as he sees them. And so he finally agrees to it. But it's something which psychologically and emotionally, he never quite recovers from this. And yeah, Dee is a rather tragic figure, but also at times a very influential figure at Elizabeth's court. She does take his advice on a number of matters. And perhaps most famously, she takes his advice on seeking to claim North America. So you could argue that Dee, historically speaking, plays a key role in England's growing ambitions to establish a North American empire. And of course, we all know where that eventually led.
Wow, what a fascinating character. I wonder why we haven't seen a movie or a series about John Dee yet. I think that would be quite good, actually.
Oh, definitely.
So I've been spending quite a bit of time in 1535 and 1536, and I recently read an account of a monk of the Charterhouse in London who in 1535 claimed to have seen the ghost of another monk called Father Raby, who died the year before. Actually, I think he saw him more than once, maybe twice, I think. So I'd love to hear more about what the Tudors believed about ghosts. ghosts and hauntings.
Yeah, well, ghosts were a very contested issue in the Reformation, actually more contested than magic. In 1535, of course, that's before really you've got the advent of Reformed doctrine. But later on, you get a dispute between Protestants and Catholics about ghosts, mainly because ghosts in the traditional view are spectres from purgatory. So when somebody dies and they have sins that have not yet been fully purged by confession and absolution, they'll end up going to purgatory in order to wait for admission to heaven at some future point. And then masses can be said for their souls, prayers can be said for their souls. That's the classic pre-Reformation Catholic view. And sometimes if somebody neglects to do something for the soul of a departed loved one, so if masses have not been said for their soul, if there haven't been prayers, if there haven't been alms given to the poor in that person's name, then the ghost will come back and will haunt. And the classic purpose of the ghost, and this goes way on actually into the 17th and 18th centuries, the classic purpose of the ghost is to right a wrong. So ghosts don't just appear to pop up behind people and say boo and scare them. Ghosts have a very particular social function. They're there in order to reinforce the wishes of the dead. And the wishes of the dead, of course, are considered sacred. Hence, you know, the writing of wills and the legal enrollment of those wills in the probate court. And so you end up with a situation where ghosts are disputed between Protestants and Catholics, because the Protestants say there's no such thing as purgatory. So if there's no such thing as purgatory, there's no such thing as ghosts. Therefore, when people see these apparitions, they're either lying or the apparition that they've seen is actually a demon from hell who is pretending to be a soul from purgatory in order to deceive that person into returning to Catholicism and holding superstitious beliefs and so forth. But that never sticks. And what you end up in England is the survival of belief in ghosts, to the extent that England, of all European countries, it has the strongest beliefs in ghosts. Right the way through to the present day. We're still obsessed with ghosts in England. It's something that really has not gone away. So I think ghosts are one of those wonderful examples of things that the Reformation totally failed to kill. There were, you know, numerous attempts, time after time after time, to get rid of ghosts and say that, you know, the Reformed doctrine has driven the ghosts away. But no, the ghosts just keep coming back for more.
That's really interesting. And actually, that makes sense when you were talking about the Catholic idea about ghosts, because I'm pretty sure that the monk at the Charterhouse had seen the ghost of someone coming back to tell them to remain steadfast. The prior, I think, had been executed and to remain steadfast and not agree to Henry's religious changes. So that's a good example, I think. All right, so this episode, we're publishing it on Friday the 13th. So I think it's only appropriate to end this part of the show by hearing about some of the other kind of weird and wonderful Tudor superstitions, and some which I'm pretty sure we still have today. Can you go through some of these with us?
Yes, indeed. I don't really like the word superstition, because I think superstition is something which is a bit of an insulting term to sort of discredit somebody's beliefs that you think are silly. And who are we to say what was silly for Tudor people to believe or not? Their world was so much scarier in a way than ours, and they had so much less control over the reality that they lived. But yes, I mean, there were certainly practices that people used to employ that in everyday life would smooth your way through and protect you from misfortune and bad luck. Although having said that, our idea of bad luck is something that didn't really exist in the Tudor period, because people believed in divine providence. And so divine providence was the idea that God or the angels were in charge of anything that happened to you, and that bad things happened to you not by accident, but because God, for some reason, had withdrawn his favor, probably because you'd committed a sin. And so, yeah, there's a much more deeply religious worldview within it, which everything happens. I mean, essentially, belief in witchcraft is very closely related to belief in misfortune. So when bad things happen to you, what do? Well, in the 16th century, you look around you. Is there anyone who wishes you ill? And if there is someone who wishes you ill, is there any evidence that that person has wished ill to other people and that bad things have happened to them? And if that's true, and if that person perhaps belongs to a lower social status, that person might be a pauper or a beggar, Perhaps that person is a woman and therefore easier to target. Perhaps that person is a widow and therefore without protection. Then that person becomes the ideal target for accusations of witchcraft. So you could argue that belief in witchcraft itself was a way of allowing people to feel better about bad things that went wrong and, you know, when misfortunes happened. And it made sense of misfortunes in a way that was perhaps in some ways necessary to people at that time. Otherwise, you know, how would they cope psychologically with all the terrible things that kept happening, all the children that kept dying, all the animals that kept dying, all the crops that kept failing in a, you know, subsistence rural economy? And so witchcraft really is an example of that. But there are also stranger beliefs attached to that. So one example which still in some areas continues, when you have eggshells left over from breaking eggs, there are still some parts of the country today where people will crush those eggshells before they throw them away, rather than throwing the eggshells away as two halves. And the reason for that was that witches were believed to use those eggshells in sympathetic magic. So they would take the eggshells and then they would essentially sink ships by magically investing the eggshells with the name of that ship and putting it into a bowl of water and sinking it, and thereby the ship would sink. So a kind of image magic, but applied to boats. And yeah, there was this strange view that the way it's expressed in later times, it was witch, you must destroy your eggshells because witches sail in eggshells. And of course, that wasn't originally what was believed. But yeah, it's the idea of sympathetic magic. And that's something still that people still do. Another example would be people, when they see salt, would be throwing it over their shoulder. And again, this is something which the idea that if a witch comes into possession of something that you own, and salt was a very precious thing in the 16th century, it was something that you would, you know, keep close to you in your store cupboard, perhaps under lock and key. And the idea that if the witch comes into possession of something that you own, then the witch can make use of it against you, particularly things like hair and fingernail clippings. And again, there's superstitions about how those should be disposed of in the right way so that witches can't get them. So yes, a lot of things that still linger in one form or another, but their original meaning is lost. And the pattern that often develops in folklore is that something starts out as a belief in magic or a belief in witchcraft, and it gradually deteriorates over time until all that's left is the idea that it's an unlucky thing to do, but it still stays there as an unlucky thing to do.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So it seems that a lot of the sort of unlucky, you know, beliefs that people have today are linked to witchcraft. I'm just thinking, you know, the black cat and that sort of thing. So that connection's quite strong still, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the black cat, because cats were particularly associated with being witches' familiars. Another one is breaking mirrors. So if you break a mirror, you get 7 years of bad luck. Well, originally, the reason why mirrors were invested with magical power is that the mirror had taken your image. And so if you broke a mirror, there was a certain sense in which you were breaking yourself, because you were breaking something that had borne your image. And so that's linked with effigy magic. And if a witch stole a mirror that somebody owned, then that would be an ideal weapon to use against somebody, to work witchcraft against them, because it had that association with the person's image. So again, there's almost always a link with witchcraft when you look back into these superstitions at some time in the past.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'd never heard of the eggshells, by the way, so that's that's a new one for me. All right, Francis, we're at the time of the show where we play a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Sure.
Okay, so name two items that are on your bucket list.
Two items that are on my bucket list. Well, being a historian, they're mostly places that I would like to see.
Yes.
That I haven't had a chance to go to. I'd love to explore some of the sites in North America that are associated with the early settlement there. So places like Jamestown in Virginia, and where Raleigh first settled in North Carolina. So those would definitely be on my bucket list. But also, if I can have that as one, my second one would be to discover a previously unknown manuscript and edit it. I would love to do that.
Oh, that would be a dream, wouldn't it? That sounds really good. So, did you have a favorite book as a child?
I did, yes. I mean, at various points, obviously, my favorite books would be different ones. But I think that, yeah, my favorite book when I was about 10 or 11 would have been Gulliver's Travels.
And what about a film? What's a film that you enjoy watching now? Something maybe you go back to and, rewatch, that sort of thing?
My favorite film is Barry Lyndon by Stanley Kubrick, which is again, it's predictable given that it's a historical film set in the 18th century.
Great. And what's your ideal Saturday night?
Well, if I'm honest, I think my ideal Saturday night would probably be staying in with a fascinating manuscript to transcribe, which sounds terribly sad, but that is what I enjoy, is kind of working at the coal face of history and creating something that's completely new and making it available to the world.
Yeah, it doesn't sound sad to me at all. What's a book that's currently on your to-be-read list?
Well, I've just got a book actually to review, which is called Cursed Britain by Thomas Waters, which is a really exciting book. That's it actually is much much later in theme than the Tudors, but it's about black magic and witchcraft from 1800 through to, well, pretty much the present day in Britain. And it's I've been something I've been looking forward to reading for a long time, so it should be fascinating.
And what's a favourite holiday destination?
Oh, well, I'm there right now, actually. I'm currently on holiday in Wales, which is one of my favourite places.
It is beautiful. I've been there, but only briefly. I need to make another trip.
Home of the Tudors.
Yes, of course. What's your go-to comfort food?
Well, I'd have to say pizza.
So I have to ask, because of the topic that we've been discussing, do you believe in ghosts?
I have never personally had a supernatural experience of this kind. People that I know well and trust have had those experiences. So what I'd say is that I keep an open mind on such matters. I think that it's fair to say that people have strange and unexplained experiences. Whether we explain those experiences by giving a traditional account of ghosts and spirits of the dead is another question. I'm honestly not sure how we explain those experiences. But I think what we can't do is just dismiss anybody who says that they've seen a ghost and say that they must have been drunk or dreaming. That's simply not plausible. People keep seeing these things, people keep having these experiences, and people keep reporting them in good faith. So I suppose I would describe myself as open-minded on that subject.
What's a great piece of advice that you've received in your life that you're willing to share with us?
One of my favorite pieces of advice is if it can be done now, do it now, which again and again in writing is something that I keep coming back to in writing and research, making sure that if you see that it's necessary to write something down, make a note of something, then yeah, do it now, and it saves time later and saves you having to go back and retread your steps.
Yeah, that's so true. That's very good advice. And lucky last, I have to ask you the time travel question. If you could travel back and see one event in Tudor history, what would it be?
I'm not sure that I would necessarily want to go back and see a particular event, actually. I think that if I could time travel, I'd like to go back and soak up the atmosphere, because I'm as interested in the whole society as I am in individual events. And the time that I would choose, if I could get in a time machine and go back to Tudor England, I'd like to see what it was like towards the end of the reign of Mary the First. So just after Catholicism had been restored in England, just before Mary's death. And what fascinates me is the extent to which people had come back to accept Catholicism, the extent to which people were resisting Catholicism. And I'd just love to walk around London or Norwich at that time and see what was really happening on the ground. What was it really like to be alive in that time?
Yeah, and quite confusing, I think, for some people going back and forth, but that would be fascinating, absolutely. Now, the very last thing we do, I always ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway. So this is just a little something that our listeners can go and explore after the episode. It might be a website or a book or a song to listen to. Do you have a Tudor takeaway?
Yes, well, I'd encourage you, if you're interested in magic in Tudor England, then I'd encourage you to go to the horse's mouth and actually seek out some of the texts that have been published. There's still not very many out there, but texts of books of magic. One of them is, I've actually edited myself, which is called The Cambridge Book of Magic, which is an edition of an early 16th century grimoire, a book of magic. There's another one which was edited not too long ago by Daniel Harms and others, which is called The Book of Oberon, which is a manuscript in the Folger Library. So there's not that many of them about, but I would encourage you to seek them out, because these are absolutely fascinating texts, and there's no substitute really for reading what magicians themselves thought they were up to. So I'd encourage you to find one of those.
They're fantastic takeaways. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Fred. So I know you're on holiday, Wales, and you took the time out to talk tutors with me, and I'm very appreciative. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.